In 1985, Shelby Smoke was diagnosed HIV positive, a fact that he did not learn by choice until a few years later. Smoke's diagnosis is compounded with the fact that he's also a hemophiliac. Set in the 1990s along the North Carolina coast, his memoir, Bleeder, traces his quest for love in a world that feels increasingly dangerous and despite a future that feels increasingly uncertain. From the bedroom to the operating room and from one hospital to the next, he seeks out hope and ultimately better health. Shelby Smoke is a poet and novelist who now teaches at Northern Virginian Community College in Arlington. He's written a memoir of his experiences with both diseases. It is entitled Bleeder, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Shelby Smoke to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
At what point, given the time that has lapsed really since this story began for you, at what point did you start to think, okay, I want to write about this and I want to explore this?
Well, I had started graduate when my health improved, and it did look like I had a future. I was starting to go to grad school and was going for creative writing. And during that period, I wrote a lot of short stories that were, in some ways, third-person removals of this story. And I think after that sort of tenure of navigating the fiction world, it became clear to me that I had to write this first. It's really, in a lot of ways, maybe it was cathartic for sure, but a purging for me to really move on and write other things. This story was blocking me, so I had to write it.
Blocking you in what way? In the sense of, I mean, it's not something. Yes, your health is first and foremost, I assume, for many of these years. But then to allow yourself to say, okay, what has to happen to say, okay, I am better and I am at a point where I can write about this and feel good about writing it?
Oh, that's I think that for me it was the process of just working through that kind of trauma. You know, I have a great network of friends, my family ever supportive, but you know, when you have traumas like this, there's still something that you have to wrestle with on a individual level by yourself. And I think that for me to sort of negotiate that so that I could open myself up maybe to other fiction possibilities and other writing, I had to work through this, and just so I could you know, work through it for myself. So there was a lot of, I guess it was my own therapy. I didn't, you know, go to any kind of standard therapy. But for me, I think that this was what I chose to do to work through that.
You were born with hemophilia, which is a rare condition, obviously quite debilitating. But it's not until your 18th birthday, you're getting ready to go off to college, that you realize or you find out that you are HIV positive.
Yeah, but I think that there was a great suspicion, and I think in a lot of ways I probably knew because, you know, I was part of the hemophilia community. A lot of the newsletters at that time, in a lot of ways, unfortunately and very sadly, they became obituary notices because a lot of my peers were, you know, succumbing to the virus and not making it, some of the boys I went to camp with. You know, I think, you know, that I lost the train of thought with my question. Can you re-ask it? Sorry.
No problem. I was asking about the point where you're 18 years old and you find out, and you address this, but I'm curious as to, when you say you had your suspicions, and I read in the introduction that you did not learn by choice until a few years later that you were HIV positive, what led to that choice of saying, you know what, I don't really want to know?
Oh, you know, the medical community did not know what to do with this for the young boys, the young hemophiliacs who were coming down with such a virus that really at that time just had no hope. It was just just a terrible thing to be burdened with for anybody. But, you know, imagine that you were 10 or 11, as I was and as a lot of boys were. So, you know, the medical profession told families, and then families individually made decisions. But, you know, at the same time, you had the swirl of Ricky Ray in Florida, Ryan White, I mean, just all this media stuff that was going on. So I think that, you know, there was the idea within my family that, you know, to shelter me, to perhaps protect me from some of that. And I was fortunate because had I developed any kind of symptoms or illnesses, you know, I would have had to have been informed, and then medical procedures would have had to have been done. But, you know, I didn't develop any of that, so that I was able to wait until 1990. And what happened in 1990 was I turned 18, and that's when the state sort of overlorded, you might say, that decision to keep it within the family, and they had mandated that all adults would be told of, you know, their test results and their status.
You find out then that you are, I mean, you're a young, heterosexual, HIV-positive hemophiliac who is starting his life, going to college, and trying to do all of the things that 18-year-old kids do.
Mm-hmm.
And it ain't easy, because these two illnesses really impact everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is where I started the book, because, you know, I teach literature, so I'm always talking about in medias res, you know, starting with the crisis. And this seemed like, you know, you look at the hemophilia, but, you know, I never knew anything different than hemophilia. And I do think there's stories there in my childhood. But, you know, this was the crisis. This was the beginning of adulthood. It was the beginning of dealing with everything. It was also the beginning of dealing with my hemophilia for myself. You know, I didn't have the comfort of family any longer. So, you know, that was its own negotiating I had to do, you know, how to get my factors, my factor, how to do my own treatments and sustain that, how to take care of my health with that. And then compounded with that, of course, as the book opens, I found out about HIV. And at that point, my numbers had declined to the point that, you know, I was immediately started on AZT, which was the only treatment at the time.
You keep, in reading this book, you all regularly have to remind yourself that, yes, this is the late 80s, early 90s, and, mm-hmm. and how much really things have changed.
Oh, yeah.
No, I mean, not only in medical terms, but in mm-hmm. in how we culturally deal with it and understand it.
No, and I think there was another interview I did for a paper, and they asked me about the quote that's at the beginning of the book from Louise Gluck, which says, "At the end of my suffering, there was an open door." And we ended up having this really long conversation about that word open, because I think in so many ways that is a key word in the book. I mean, that's where the book ends. The last chapter is the open door, where there's hope, there's healing. But I think, too, you know, I could, you know, start living a life that wasn't always more open in a way that, you know, as much of the book chronicles, I could not be open about a lot of this. But yeah, I do think that, you know, socially and medically, so much has changed from that time. So people who, you know, weren't aware of that, for them it might be kind of enlightening. And for people who live through that time, it'll be sort of a memory, and they'll click on a few things and, you know, understand and recall how bad things were.
Did you ever want to just stay home and say, okay, I'm going to go to college nearby, I'm going to stick close, I'm going to have this support and be grounded, or did you really need that, I have to get away and I have to be independent?
I don't know if it was that as so certain as I have to get away and be independent. I think it was that I wanted the natural transition from, you know, high school to college. I'd always known I'd gone to would go to college, and, you know, I didn't want to change that path for myself. And I think, too, I grew up in a small town that, you know, didn't offer a lot of those kinds of educational opportunities. So for me to have stayed there would have made education in itself difficult and would have changed a lot of things. And I think, too, a motif that runs through the book is the sea and the ocean. And I think in a lot of ways, and I chose to go to UNC Wilmington, you know, I was offered things to maybe do other colleges like UNC, you know, but I just wanted to go where the ocean was. That's not usually how you make a choice about education, but it was for me.
It is for many kids, I think. and when you then when you because this is very much a love story. I mean, this is very much about you trying to come to terms with. I mean, you have a chapter in here of a guide to dating with the handbook to dating with HIV. I mean, this is very much trying to figure out how to be a normal kid and growing up and have a relationship where you have these conditions that obviously are, again, both culturally and medically very challenging.
Mm-hmm. And I think one thing, that chapter, I don't know what the readers will think, but I put it in there because I thought it was a touch of humor in there, you know, being catty about, you know, when do you tell someone you're HIV positive, what date you do. And also what is funny about that chapter for me is that there's absolutely no dating in it.
Right.
So it's just about talking about dating, which I imagine a lot of men and women, that's what happens. They talk about what they do when they finally get the date or get the opportunity. But one thing that was definitely different in my scenario, the idea of a one-night stand or any kind of loose relationship just was just seemed like a logical impossibility. So, you know, things for me, as the book narrates, were got pretty serious pretty quick. And you either got on board or you didn't.
Not to give away the ending of the book, but in the acknowledgments, you do thank your wife, Vicky.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, the story has a happy ending.
Yes, yeah, and you know, and some people have asked me, you know, why did you end the book where you do? Because it kind of ends in 1998, 99, and it doesn't follow me through to, you know, my marriage a few years ago to Vicky and then moving to D.C. and all the wonderful things that have evolved from that. But, you know, I think, there's two answers to that question. Why does the book end where it does and doesn't have kind of the epilogue? One is that when I started writing this, it was the year 2000. So that's how long it has taken from sort of draft to revision to final publication. But the other thing was that when I was revising it for the press and I knew it was going to be published, you know, reading as much literature as I do and, you know, just studying it, to me, the story completed the narrative arc that was set in motion. So to change that, you know, that was the ending for the story that was set in motion. You know, it does have the happy ending if you go and you read the acknowledgments and sort of piece things together from various interviews and things like that, or if you just happen to shoot me an email.
You'll tell us all about the happy ending.
Right.
Shelby Smoke is the author of Bleeder, a memoir. It is published by Michigan State University Press. Shelby, thank you very much for sharing your story with us this morning.
Thank you.
Best of luck with the book.
Okay, thank you.
Great pleasure. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.